Could you suggest one thing that we as individuals could do to help build a better relationship and dialogue with the government politic? What would that be? There's a little cluster of things that I think Christians in particular might very well like to reflect on. One is very simply praying for your Member of Parliament, and coming out of that, of course, is building a relationship with your Member of Parliament and trying to make sure that local MPs do get invited to engage with the Christian community wherever you are. And at election time, churches are remarkably well placed, in my experience, to organise hustings for candidates. I think at both the last elections, there was very good evidence for saying that where the church had organised public hearings for candidates for public office, they had been better attended than in any other context by a very substantial factor. So that's something worth thinking about if you want to get engaged in a good mutual debate. Do you think that sometimes it's possible for the political realm to prophesy to the church and other religious institutions when they fall short of their calling? Yes, I do. I think that in the history of Western Europe, there have been moments where the wider society has, so to speak, called the church to account for not following its own truest instincts. And I've often used the analogy of the church itself having lit a very long fuse which trails outside the boundaries of the church and explodes sometimes in the face of the church itself. Society brings back to the church its own deepest convictions and says, isn't this what you meant? And I like to think that the history of feminism has been a bit like that, but that might take me on quite a long excursus. But I do think that it's often been the ambient society that has taken more to heart some of what the Bible has said about the rights of women than the church has. This is a very interesting question indeed. Does Christian resistance to what goes against God's justice amount to rushing to God's help in his divine weakness? Doesn't this make Christians appear much more powerful than their God seemingly is? There's a very profound theological insight in that. And that's why I don't think, as a matter of fact, Christians ought to rush to God's assistance as if God needed our help to maintain his cause or his justice. I do think, though, that's rather different from the Christian claiming the liberty not to obey a law which in conscience is believed to be unjust, because that may bring the Christian into just the marginality and the vulnerability, which is where God meets us in the cross. Recently, for a variety of reasons, I reread a play by Charles Williams, the Anglican novelist and poet and critic of the 30s, prominent in the 20s and 30s, the play of his on my predecessor, Thomas Cranmer. And at one point, one of the figures who represents a particular form of religious extremism in the play says to Cranmer something like, how is God going to be safe if we stop killing? Now, that's, of course, what a good many Christians over the centuries have rather taken for granted. That, I think, is a chilling, an appalling, almost a blasphemous observation. And that's not what I mean by the Christian claiming certain rights of dissent. In the sense of political that I use tonight, was Jesus apolitical? No, I don't think he was. Jesus was certainly in no sense a partisan in the politics of his day. But it's perfectly clear from the Gospels that what he intended to do was to establish a community, a people, an Israel, a community in which God was reflected, or not, in the way in which people related to one another. And that's why the church, begins with Jesus, not with St. Paul, because Jesus deals with a community, with the exclusion from community that affected the sick or the unclean, for example. His miracles of healing are very often to bring the excluded within. And so I don't think you could say he was apolitical. He was constantly being nudged and shunted into position by those who wished him to take their side in a political conflict. But he evades those pressures. He evades them not by taking refuge in an internal world of spirituality, but by acting to recreate community in his own terms. I mentioned in my remarks the renewed debate about torture. And there's a question about whether the rights of the few or the rights of the many predominate if the use of torture is in order to prevent a terrorist attack. I would still have to say that there are some things which, when we do them, so alter the moral character of our own position that we only do them at the cost of undermining everything we stand for. And that's why I believe, even in such circumstances, torture is inadmissible. It's never been a successful way of getting reliable information. To put it mildly, it's not as if you've got a cast iron case for its efficiency. But even if you had, I would say, as I have to say about nuclear weapons, there are some things which, the use of which, represents an abandonment of our own moral claims. And that's why I think we mustn't give in. The human right to influence can become control. Fundamentalisms, atheistic, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, politics and religion, comment. Influence can become control, yes, which is why every body, religious or otherwise, claiming the right to persuade, and I would underline persuade rather than influence, which is a more nebulous and perhaps more dangerous word, everybody that claims the right to try and persuade needs at the same time to have a very robust doctrine of legitimate dissent. That's why I said the believer needs to be active for the sake of the conscience of the unbeliever, just as much as the other way around. I think if that is so, if the priority of ongoing disagreement is accepted, then the claim to a right to persuade is proper. What I mean by that is, if you win the argument on some controversial matter, that doesn't give you the right to stop the argument forever. You can't close it off. Winning any argument in political terms is a short-term thing. It's worth trying when you care deeply about the issues involved. But you can't, if you win, close it off and assume you now have the right, the mandate, to allow no further change. So, there was a question in here somewhere about the rights and the limits of democracy. And while I think the Christian Church, like other bodies, needs to have some skepticism about whether there's one form of democracy applicable to absolutely everybody everywhere, there is an element of democracy, the simple right of disagreement, which the Church does need to defend. If politics is the science of living together with justice and the Church is involved in that, why has not more effort been made by the Church to oppose the abolition of the blasphemy law, when blasphemy, as Leslie Newbegin said, is the poisoning of the wellsprings of social survival and justice? A very current question. I wasn't able to be in the Lords for the debate on the blasphemy amendment, but I was able to say something about it a couple of weeks before in the Lords. And the problem that I think many Christians felt in conscience about this was that the blasphemy law had been used consistently only in circumstances where social disorder was involved, not as a matter of ideological principle, for a long, long time. And that suggested it had become a dead letter. The point that the Archbishop of York and myself made in writing to the Prime Minister about it was, if the provisions in the religious hatred legislation cover some of what is legitimate concern in the existing common law of blasphemy, then we don't want to go to the stake for the existing position. That, I think, was why not everybody wanted to put their neck on the line for this particular bit of the law. And the concern which the blasphemy law rightly covers is a concern about, I think, a general register or tone within our society, which is quite simply, as I was saying a few minutes ago, respectful of disagreement. And there are certain kinds of public utterance, publication, which do not respect disagreement or difference. Now, the level at which that impinges on freedom of speech has notoriously been very hard to calculate. But there are areas of concern there. They're not adequately provided for under the existing blasphemy law. Perhaps they're better catered for in a law about religious hatred, such as has been passed and is now developing in practice, and we'll see what happens. Why not vigorously pursue political power to effect the honouring of the faith-based values one holds to the greatest degree practical? Whenever there have been Christian political parties, they've tended to turn into something rather different before very long. Groups that are more and more dominated by one social interest or another. Groups that let go of radical Christian political commitments in order to be acceptable. I'd much prefer to see Christians being unreliable party members. That is, people who always have rather awkward questions about the political affiliations they're in the middle of, than trying to have a watertight, consistent Christian political approach. The history of all that is pretty unpromising, whether it's Christian Democrats in Europe or the alliance of certain Christian groupings with the political right in the United States. I've been asked how I'd rate the health of the American political system as well as the British. Not being an American citizen, I don't think I'd better say very much about that, except to observe a real anxiety about the way in which, for high office in the United States, it's impossible to campaign without what, for British people, are unimaginably vast financial resources. I don't think that's good for a democracy. There's a question here about public and private life and whether personal morality impinges on one's attitude to politicians. And people will often ask about whether the shadowy bits of a politician's private life are relevant to their public credibility. I don't think there's a watertight distinction here between the public and the private. I deeply deplore the way in which the private life of politicians is a matter for idle prurience and curiosity. I think that if a politician's personal life is characterized by, what should I say, by an untrustworthiness in a wide area of relationships, I would have some questions about their trustworthiness in politics. I don't think that's an absolute or simple guide, but I'm unwilling to make a complete disjunction here between the private and the public. It's one person we're talking about, and if they are in the habit of untrustworthiness in one area, I'd need to be convinced that they were trustworthy in others. Is there a fundamental conflict between those who base politics on revelation and those who base politics on reason alone? I haven't met all that many people who base politics on reason alone. Even if they think they do, they're very often taking for granted a good many hidden moral and even spiritual assumptions. Reason alone is often identified with managing a variety of people's self-interests. And that gets you so far. It doesn't get you to the point where, if you like, politics turns into something a little bit bigger than just the calculation of self-interest, when it understands something about obligation outside the immediate, when politicians act for the sake of the poor elsewhere, or for the sake of the environment, generations on, or whatever. I don't think that's covered just by classical accounts of self-interest. And in that sense, I don't think it's just about reason. There's something about vision and moral energy in there somewhere. So I'm not sure I'd accept, again, an absolute difference between revelation and reason in that connection. Can politics live without faith? I think my answer to the last question might suggest that I don't think it can, really. Faith of one sort or another. What I call moral energy and imagination. And should politicians give direct expression to their religious convictions in framing laws for the benefit of the community? I hope so. I hope that what makes their minds up as they vote for this law or that law is shaped by who they are as people, including their convictions of faith. But that's rather different from saying that their agenda should be dictated by a set of religious principles which they go in to enact. It's the Christian politician business again, or the Christian political party. So I want to see people across the road there acting on their Christianly informed consciences when they vote. Absolutely. That's why I believe that there should be free vote on certain bits of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Bill, incidentally, because that's a conscience issue for so many people. Now, there are a number of predictably quite tricky questions about the establishment of the church. And let me try and take a few of those. One intriguing one is, should the Archbishop of Canterbury be a brackets, good, close brackets, politician? The Archbishop of Canterbury is bound to be a politician in the sense that he has got to think about the understanding and the management of a quite varied and often rather unruly Christian community, the Church of England and the Anglican Church worldwide. And of course, there are politics in that. Understanding power, understanding responsibility, transparency, accountability. The Archbishop's bound to be a politician. But in the context of our society, I think an Archbishop, like any other Christian, and particularly any other Christian pastor or teacher, does have the responsibility of trying to move on the sort of debates I've been talking about and draw out the assumptions of people in our society about human dignity and human nature. In that sense, a politician. And by long tradition, this is the establishment question, the Archbishop is in fact a legislator. And like any other legislator, as I've just said, the Archbishop needs to vote according to his conscience. So I hope the Archbishop, when he does that, is in some sense a good politician. But is there still a case for an established church in England? To what extent would the removal of bishops in the House of Lords result in social anemia? How do you view the possible loss of the bishops from a reorganized House of Lords? Isn't having the Queen at its head itself a political statement by the church? And doesn't that inextricably align the church with a certain political view? So I mean, some quite direct questions on establishment. The case for the establishment of the Church of England is, I suppose, the case for two things. One, for the recognition by the state of some element in its life answerable to more than narrowly political interest. The state says, we keep a place there for a community recognized by us as a state, which looks beyond the boundaries of the immediate political conflicts. That's one part of the case. The other part is the state's recognition that everyone in the nation has the right to access some kind of spiritual service. Quite a lot of both of those, I think, can be met in ways other than the establishment as we now see it. And I had 10 years as a bishop in a disestablished church in Wales without noticing a great deal of difference a lot of the time. So I don't believe, in general principle, that disestablishment is lethal for the church, or that the establishment in its present form is a ditch the church would have to die in. I have more faith in the church than that. At the same time, if disestablishment meant the pushing of a strong secularizing agenda, or the removing of that sense that a state needs people in it who have obligations and affiliations beyond, to a transcendent reality, then I'd be worried. I'd think that the state would lose out in that. Bishops in the Lords, I think in the context of what I've just been saying, that's where the case comes in. That's where the legislature allows that there are people in it licensed to ask awkward questions on a religious basis. They wouldn't, in principle, have to be bishops, and it may well be that in the future of the House of Lords we'll see other religious bodies drawn in. I'm sure that would be right. But harking back to something I said in the lecture about the importance of where we actually are and where we've actually come from, simple removal of bishops from the Lords might well be the amputation of a genuinely useful part of the polity. Not because the bishops are clinging to privilege. It's remarkable how unprivileged it sometimes feels when you're sitting through a very long debate in the Lords and wondering exactly how you're going to get your last train home. But as a matter of witness to that more than political dimension that I touched upon, I think I'm nearly out of time, and there's a whole bundle of very, very interesting things here. May I just take two questions, possibly three, because two are quite closely connected. What about the responsibility of Christians to take a stand for human rights, the rights of those suffering injustice like the plight of Palestine? Why aren't Christians taking an active part in the peace process, claiming their part of the Holy Land? I think Christians actually are taking a part, sometimes quite prominently, in that discussion. Many of you will be aware of the role that Christians of different confessions have played in the peace process in the Holy Land as elsewhere. And whenever I've been in Jerusalem, I've found a remarkable willingness on the part of a number of religious leaders to get together and engage with this, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim. My predecessor launched some years ago the Alexandria process, designed to bring religious leaders of all these traditions into the peace process much more visibly. And in terms of standing up for human rights, generally, the rights of the disadvantaged, I think the record of the church in many contexts worldwide is not bad and sometimes wonderful. Whether it's the South African history, which is, I guess, in most people's minds, the history of many of those in Latin America who've stood alongside the poorest, or the history of, the current fact of those in India who so vigorously defend the rights of so-called untouchables, in southern India especially. And the last question, should the current preoccupation with rights be balanced with a greater recognition of responsibilities? I think that's a welcome question because it allows me to underline once again what I was saying right at the beginning. The nature of the Christian church is that it is a community where people take responsibility to and for each other before God. And the most fundamental question about the morality, the moral colouring of the Christian church is how effective is that responsibility to and for one another. And that is part of what the church, to use the language I used earlier, proposes to society as a vision and an ideal. Sorry, I've kept you over the time. Thank you.